Welcome to the Monitor Daily Podcast. It's Thursday, September 22nd. Thanks for joining us. I'm Clara Germani.
And I'm Luke Cregan.
Before there was Brown versus Board of Education, there was Mendez versus Westminster. The Orange County, California suburb, Westminster, is one of those post-war drive-by burgs that are an unremarkable blur at freeway speed. However, the quiet stratifications of local history are quite remarkable. Indigenous culture overlaid by vast 19th century Mexican land-grant ranchos, then the fragrant citrus boom of the early 20th century. And since the 1970s, it's become one of the biggest concentrations of Vietnamese immigrants in the U.S., known as Little Saigon. But in the 1940s, a group of Mexican-American families here waged a pioneering battle against the sorting of children by ethnicity, Anglo-American children to one school, Mexican-American to another. The reason, a local official testified, was Mexican children have to be Americanized, taught cleanliness of mind, mannerisms, dress. It was bracing inspiration for forced segregation. Grade schooler Sylvia Mendez, who today in her 80s is still on the civil rights speaking circuit, was barred from a school close to the land her father ranched and sent to what officials called a Mexican school. In 1943, Sylvia became the lead plaintiff in the case, which did not claim the segregation was racial discrimination because Mexicans were legally considered white. Rather, it argued that the social, psychological, and pedagogical effects of separation damaged Mexican-American children. They won. And Thurgood Marshall used the precedent in constructing his Brown versus Board of Education Supreme Court case that, in 1954, successfully established that separate but equal education facilities for racial minorities are inherently unequal. This fall, Westminster's opening the Mendez Historic Freedom Trail and Monument. It's a creative oasis of landscaping, art, and historical interpretation commemorating the courage and perseverance of the families who won their desegregation case. Last week, Jeff Hittenberger, Vanguard University Professor of Education and the creator of the trail's interpretive panels, brought student teachers to see the nearly finished site. Before his course, none of his students had heard of Sylvia Mendez. One graduate student, Gilbert Angeles, noted that before he studied the Mendez case and talked with his mother about it, he'd had no idea she'd spoken only Spanish when she came to the U.S. from Mexico and rose from janitorial work to become the professional director of a mental health program. Exiting the monument, Mr. Angeles gushed, comparing the sacrifice and perseverance of Sylvia's parents to his mom's. "This is our history, too," he said. Now, today's stories. Our first story. Both sides agree the current system isn't equipped to handle such a huge influx of migrants. But after decades of partisan finger-pointing, agreeing on solutions remains a significant challenge.
Since the spring, the Republican governors of Texas and Arizona have been sending busloads of migrants north to Washington, New York, and Chicago. Last week, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis upped the ante by sending two chartered flights, unannounced, to Martha's Vineyard, a vacation haunt of former President Barack Obama and other wealthy liberals. The governor's campaign has supercharged the national debate over how to handle a migration crisis in the southwestern border, where the largest influx in decades is overwhelming law enforcement resources and further clogging an immigration and asylum processing system that was never designed to handle such numbers. For years, Republicans and Democrats have failed to make the hard compromises necessary to achieve comprehensive immigration reform while accusing each other of exploiting the issue for political gain. And although the upcoming elections may only intensify that dynamic, some experts remain hopeful that an increasingly frustrated public will pressure leaders to quit the blame game and work together toward solutions. Teresa Cardinal Brown, a former advisor with Customs and Border Protection, who now works for the Bipartisan Policy Center in Washington, says, "Don't keep coming and telling me how upset I need to be at the other guy about it." Ms. Brown asks, "Why don't you fix it?" This story was reported by Krista Case Bryant and Sophie Hills in Washington for The Monitor.
Has the idea of bringing innovation to public schools after the lockdown years come to fruition? The opportunity remains, but for now, small steps rather than big leaps guide progress.
With classes back in session, experts say the quest to reimagine teaching and learning, which was urged during the pandemic, has resulted in modest changes like greater use of technology and tutoring. Some alternatives, such as virtual schooling and microschools, still attract supporters. And districts have started to give more attention to the mental health needs of students and teachers. But the prolonged difficulties of navigating COVID-19 protocols and the additional scrutiny of teachers because of culture wars has left many educators and families exhausted and longing to return to normal. Those who want to see greater changes say that innovation, at least in the current education landscape, will take more time and persistence. Scott McLeod, a professor at the University of Colorado Denver, says, "Our mindsets about what school looks like and feels like and how it should operate are pretty deeply embedded." He continues, "It's not that we're going to snap our fingers and reinvent schools. Community members and school districts need to form alliances to make progress," says parent and co-founder of the Oakland Reach, Lakeisha Young. "We can't just wag our fingers at the system," she says. "We have to create the solutions and bring these solutions to the table." This story was reported by Chelsea Sheasley for The Monitor.
Trust in electoral outcomes is a foundation of democracy. A study of Mexico shows how quickly that confidence can be lost and how much time and effort it takes to rebuild.
Mexico's violent democracy isn't often held up as an example to follow, and the country experienced one of the most infamous cases of a defeated presidential candidate claiming fraud. When Andrés Manuel López Obrador lost the 2006 presidential race by less than a percentage point, he organized encampments in downtown Mexico City, driving the capital to a halt. Voter confidence in the Electoral Institute plummeted. But today, as political figures from Donald Trump in the United States to Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil cast doubts on their electoral systems, Mexico's National Electoral Institute, known as INE, is one of the most trusted civilian-run institutions in the country. Reforms put in place in the aftermath of Mexico's deeply contested 2006 vote may offer some important lessons on maintaining, or regaining, citizen trust in elections. Mr. López Obrador eventually backed down, running for president twice more and finally winning by a landslide in 2018. He's halfway through his six-year term, and INE has nearly 70% public trust. Guillermo Trejo, professor of comparative politics at the University of Notre Dame, says, "On the electoral dimension, Mexico provides lessons for other countries." He adds, "Until recently in the U.S., no one knew who was organizing elections, who was in charge. In Mexico, everyone knows." This story was reported by Whitney Ulick in Mexico City for The Monitor.
Drought has created stress on water supplies and agriculture in numerous parts of the world. This adds urgency to getting better at responding. Early warning systems are just the start.
As we pass the official end of summer in the Northern Hemisphere, drought persists in many areas, notably parts of Europe and the southwestern United States. In the Southern Hemisphere, a lack of rain is creating an increasingly dire situation in the Horn of Africa. The challenges for agriculture and water access, including concerns about the role played by climate change, are putting fresh focus on action in response. Droughts, along with other kinds of climate change impacts, are indeed already becoming more intense, more frequent, lasting longer, says Rebecca Carter of the World Resources Institute in Washington, citing the published consensus of global climate scientists. Dr. Carter, who leads the World Resources Institute's climate resilience practice, says the United Nations push for early warning systems is a really important first step. From farms to cities worldwide, new efforts to manage water are needed too. Some actions might help both to adapt to climate change and to slow it. Lands that lose forests and vegetation are more susceptible to runoff, degrading soils, and worsening droughts and floods when they occur. Reforestation can build resilience and also mitigate climate change, Dr. Carter says, because those trees store carbon. This story was reported by Mark Trumbull and Jacob Turcotte for The Monitor.
The struggle for equal rights was carried out by Black and white women, but their contributions were not equally acknowledged. A historian shows how a diverse array of voices enriched the women's movement.
In her latest book, Formidable, American Women and the Fight for Equality, 1920 to 2020, historian and scholar Elizabeth Griffith takes a comprehensive look at the women's movement in the United States through the lens of race, politics, and society. She explores the differing motivations of Black and white women who are fighting for equality and how they first banded together but then divided over competing priorities. In an interview, Dr. Griffith says that what she learned in researching the book is that the story of women's rights is complex. You cannot generalize about women in America, she says. Women are very diverse. Dr. Griffith sees positive signs in the large numbers of women registering to vote, both Republican and Democrat, who are energized by the issue of reproductive rights since the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. Dr. Griffith says, that is heartening to me, because maybe it means we can begin to find more common ground among women in different parts of the political, economic, and racial spectrum. She makes the case that women today can play a role in addressing the deep divisions in the country. She says, women have gifts for connecting through conversation and finding common ground. There's just evidence of that forever in American history. She adds, we need to find ways to repair this country, and women can be good at that. You can find the full conversation between Dr. Griffith and Monitor reporter Krista Case Bryant in today's issue.
Now, commentary from the Monitor's editorial board on Arab-Israeli relations. In a speech today at the United Nations, Israel's caretaker Prime Minister Yair Lapid revived an idea that many Israelis and Palestinians have long abandoned. It is to set up a Palestinian state alongside Israel, or what he called two states for two peoples. While the details of creating a two-state solution remain as difficult as when the concept was more viable decades ago, Mr. Lapid's offer seems shaped by an emerging recognition in the Middle East of equality among all peoples. Since 2020, four Arab states have normalized relations with Israel, joining Egypt and Jordan. Other Muslim countries, such as Indonesia, could soon join them. Within Israel itself, the 1 in 5 citizens who are Arab supported a ruling coalition in 2021, put together by Mr. Lapid, but which fell apart June 30th, as he seeks to remain prime minister after a November 1 election. The former TV anchor told the UN that the cultural mosaic of Israeli society reflects full civic equality between Arabs and Jews. Peace between former foes, he said, is not a compromise, but rather the victory of all that is good. If Mr. Lapid is serious about his offer, the next step would be a meeting with Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas. Such a meeting would send a signal that equality is possible between the two peoples, something the Mideast has long sought. That's a wrap for the news. You can find the full-length versions of these stories in today's issue or at csmonitor.com/daily. For more Monitor audio, including our serial podcasts, go to csmonitor.com/podcasts. Thanks for joining us today. Please come back tomorrow when our Scott Peterson reports on how a spirit of freedom is infusing anti-hijab protests in Iran despite a violent crackdown. Today's Christian Science Spiritual Perspective contributor shares how, when we're letting love for God and for our neighbors motivate us, blessings ensue, even when circumstances seem less than ideal. You can find the column in today's issue or at csmonitor.com/daily. We want to give a quick thanks to our staff, including today's audio production team, Jeff Turton and Luke Cregan. Thank you.
This podcast is produced by the Christian Science Monitor. Copyright 2022.